Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
This was the week where summer turned to fall, and here in the Netherlands that is quite literally the case. Warm and sunny weather has been replaced with wind and rain. The perfect condition for a cold. And a second wave of COVID-19, of course. All over Europe, countries and regions are being confronted with stricter lockdowns, and the discussion on tracking app continues. Where in the UK, a COVID app has been released, developed in close cooperation with the Information Commissioner's Office, in the Netherlands the underlying legislative framework still has not been finalized by Parliament. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. And unfortunately, as if 2020 wasn't bad enough already, we lost Ruth Bader Ginsburg this past week. She was admired by many lawyers and legal scholars, not just in the United States, and irrespective of your political preferences, I think all can agree she was a legal giant and a great advocate for equality for all and social justice. We don't have a guest this week, but you will get an extensive update on what has happened in the world of privacy and data protection. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. Let's jump straight into our unexpected question, because today is going to be a fabulous episode. Paul, what was the last thing you baked or cooked?
The last thing I baked was a pear pie. Ooh. With the pears from my own garden.
Oh, very nice. I think the last thing I baked, and I'm going to go with baked rather than cooking, was just chicken tenders.
Well, still, that's nice.
I mean, flavored with lemon, herb, and garlic, but yes, chicken tenders. I try to prep meals on the weekends to hold me throughout the week.
Yeah, I get that.
Chicken tenders was it. Yeah. So, because I'm not exactly eating healthy anymore. Yeah, I think the quarantine 15 has now become the COVID-19 pounders.
Yeah, I recognize that. But the pear pie was actually for dinner with friends. So I just a regular, like an apple pie base that you would do, and then a frangipane on top, so almonds and sugar and egg, and then the fresh pears from the garden, at least the ones that I could save from my dog.
That actually sounds fantastic. One of my favorite desserts is I have to do gluten-free, but one of my favorite is just a crumb cobbler, usually cherry, sometimes berry, but I love crumb cobbler. And I actually found a fantastic gluten-free crust. I think it's figs and crushed pecans, maybe, or crushed almonds. But mix it up, and you could almost eat it by itself, just the crust. But then the paleo cheesecake was cashews that had been soaked overnight and then ground up to a creamy consistency to substitute for cheesecake. It was actually not horrible.
I'm not sure whether that's a recommendation to try it, but
I haven't made it again, but actually not horrible. But thank you very much for mentioning Justice Ginsburg. As you can imagine, here in the United States, it has created a lot of emotion just losing her. She has been an icon to so many, and not just women, not just because of the women's rights and the equality that, you know, she advocated for so strongly. Tiny but fierce is definitely a word that comes to mind for her. But unlike a lot of women icons that we in the law may have, Justice Ginsburg was actually known to be, in my mind, the penultimate female professional. She was known to be wickedly brilliant, fierce, outspoken, but she was also known to be a great mother and a great wife.
And restless and with a good sense of humor. I mean, from
yes,
the documentary I saw, the RBG documentary, I think she basically worked all the time.
Yeah, basically. And I never had the occasion to meet her, but I did meet her husband. He came and spoke at our law school, and he's just phenomenal. And if you watch the documentary, but you might not have kept up, a lot of people weren't really that aware of her husband, because once she became a justice, all the attention was on her. But she actually put her career essentially on the back burner to support him. And so when it became time for her career to advance and being appointed, you know, federal court, not just Supreme Court, he put his on the back burner to support her. And just listening to him talk, his utter love and support and devotion and respect to her just oozed right out of him. That's probably not the best imagery, but he was just so open about it. And meeting him made my respect for her ratchet up another notch, because when you hear someone's significant other talk about them in such respectful tones and so honest, you know, so honest, so upfront about it, it makes you respect the person.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too many people actually, you know, do joking insults about their significant others. And I've never appreciated that, no matter how many insulting jokes I do about my husband. I've never appreciated that. But to be frank, I don't do it in public. So, you know, I respect those that respect each other. But let's talk about her career a little bit. You know, what she has written, the opinions, the dissents. I think you and I both looked for any particular opinion she wrote or dissented based on any privacy cases. A lot of what she authored on was women's rights and equality, mm-hmm. things like that. So that was really good. But it said she authored the majority opinion 5-21 times, and she authored dissents in an 8-1 decision 9 times. So she was the sole dissenter. Mm-hmm. 9 times.
That's pretty impressive.
That is
very. She was very principled, I guess, and from what I've seen. And I mean, every constitutional debate or every Supreme Court debate in the US at some point, probably, at least from the European perspective, would turn to Roe versus Wade, the abortion case. And from what I understood from all the obituaries, but also reading some of the cases again, is that she actually objected to that case, and not so much for the outcome, but for the reasoning. And that is where she did make a privacy statement, because Roe v. Wade was construed based on Article 4, the woman's right to privacy and to make her own choices in life, which you could say indeed is a privacy issue. And she said, no, this is not a privacy issue. This is an equality issue about giving people the choice to, well, to giving people the opportunity to make their own choices in life and to choose their own destiny and their own road ahead. So from that perspective, she did look at privacy, but maybe not so much at data protection.
Right, exactly. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you caught the picture, but her lying in state and over 100, and I'm almost going to break out in tears here, over 100 of her clerks showed up for the casket to be brought into the building.
Yeah, I saw that picture. It was very moving, very impressive, and we'll post a link in the show notes. Yeah. I thought it was really great to see. The one case that I would have loved to hear her views up on was the Verizon case, actually. Verizon case brought to the court by Epic in 2013 following the Snowden revelations. And I think our listeners know by now how fond I am of these national surveillance discussions, but many may not know that my final thesis in law school was about constitutional review. And I studied quite a bit.
Big surprise.
I looked quite a bit at the U.S. Supreme Court as a possible model for the Netherlands, because we do not have constitutional review. It is in the Constitution that constitutional review is not allowed. And that is an ongoing debate already since the Constitution was first drafted in the early 1800s, that we actually should have constitutional review. But so far, a 2/3 majority was not reached, which is required to change our constitution. But I looked at some of the systems for constitutional review in France, where you have the ex ante review. So before a law or a bill becomes a law, you can go to the Constitutional Court for review. The German system, where it's fully decentralized, and the US system, where it's centralized with a Supreme Court doing the constitutional review in final instance. And that is probably the moment when I first started also looking at Justice Ginsburg and became impressed by who she was, and following the court over time and seeing the changes and hearing the bigger voices in the court. Yeah, it was impressive. And I think this was not the news I wanted to wake up with at the end of last week.
Yeah, it was really sad. And there's a lot of opinions over here flying around about pretty much everything surrounding her death, whether that she was Jewish and holding a memorial for her and letting her lie in state goes against the traditions. So we're hearing a lot there. As you know, Trump is expected to announce his nominee on Saturday. This goes back 4 years ago when we had 9 months mm-hmm. of an empty seat under President Obama, and yet everyone argued that he should not appoint someone in an election year. And here we are, you know, 5 weeks from an election, and he plans to appoint someone. And it's pretty much people expect the Senate to vote on it and not to hold it off. So it's very controversial for a lot of reasons. So here in the U.S., and it's funny, Emerald actually wrote me and said she can imagine how we're feeling over here. And my response back is, yeah, I don't know if this is going to energize the American citizens to speak up and take action, or if this is just going to completely wear us down to where it just wipes all life out of us. So it's interesting to see the reactions to it. But our question of the day reminded me of an article that I read, and I just sent you the link so we can put it in the show notes, from Nina Trottenberg. Rotenberg, with NPR, who posted an article about 5 decades of friendship with Justice Ginsburg. And in one of when her husband was sick and she was taking care of him, Justice Ginsburg was taking care of her husband, and she was basically doing it all herself. Nina baked her something and put it in a tin container. And as they were leaving, Nina's husband, and I'm sorry, it might be Nina, husband asked her if she knew how to heat it up. And she said, yes, I just put it in the microwave. And they're like, no, this is a metal container. You don't put it in the microwave. You put it in the oven. And they said that she, you know, nodded and said, okay. And they looked at her and were like, do you know how to turn the oven on? So as much as I say she was the penultimate, apparently dealing with cooking and baking was not the big thing.
Well, she didn't have the time.
You know, I don't find that to be a flaw at all. I find that to be actually charming. Absolutely
I agree. Charming. There is one more story that comes to mind when speaking about Supreme Court justices and the right to privacy and data protection. And
you're just going to keep bringing us back to the topic of the podcast, aren't you?
Well, not completely, because this is still also, I think, about Justice Ginsburg, or at least about the next steps to be taken for the court. Because I'm wondering whether during the confirmation hearings for whatever presumptive justice Mr. Trump might nominate, whether the right to privacy will be coming up and will be coming an issue. Because if you remember from about 20 years ago, there was a TV show called The West Wing.
Yes, I loved it. My husband and I actually that's a big story for how we met.
Well, maybe we'll discuss it some other time. I know an episode of The West Wing being recorded right now as part of the election campaign. So it is coming sort of back. But there was an episode where they were discussing the nomination of a new Supreme Court justice. And there is an argument in the Oval Office being made on what the issues would be where the justice would have a voice. And they mention abortion and women's rights as the issue for the 60s and the 70s. And they argue some economical rights for the 80s and the 90s. And for the zeros and the tens, they say, well, the issue for these coming years will be the right to privacy. What will happen with our data, especially online? And that episode is almost 20 years old. And I'm still surprised if you look at the argument being made, I think it's by Sam Seaborn, played by Rob Lowe, you just hear the same arguments we are still making today about the importance of the right to privacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I use one of the quotes from when his character was retiring, was going to California to run for office, and they were considering hiring Will, and he left him a note that said, he's one of us. I actually do use that a lot mm-hmm. when I talk about people in privacy and I share, and I'm like, he's one of us or she's one of us. But actually, yes. And there is something known as the Ginsburg precedent.
Tell me.
That when she was undergoing her hearings to be appointed, she declined to answer questions about any of these controversial topics, whether it was separation of church and state, whether it was rights of the disabled, whether it was abortion, anything like that. She declined to do it, and she defended her responses and became known for no hints, no forecasts, no previews, no insight into their personal views. And of course, there was opinions on that that said, you know, she authored over 300 opinions as a federal judge over 13 years. So we kind of know what her thoughts on the matters are. She shares her opinions through her work, but it's interesting how she set a precedent for that because, and this was something that also came up. And of course, this is more, you know, US politics than it is privacy, but it relates to privacy because no hints, no forecast, no previews, mm-hmm. her right to privacy of her opinions. And it's interesting because a lot of people now say, or not a lot of people, there is a thing going around about how she should have stepped down from the Supreme Court and that lifetime appointment should be done away with. And I started to say, you know, maybe it is a time to consider that maybe lifetime appointment should go away. But then I started thinking of all the reasons for it, and they shouldn't. A lot of justices, actually, their opinions may not disclose their personal opinions because they have to divorce themselves from the subjectivity mm-hmm. and they have to be objective over what the law is. Although, of course, they're allowed to bring their subjectivity into it. That's kind of why you select judges. But the fact that it's the lifetime appointment to a federal bench, whether it's a federal court or whether it's the Supreme Court, which is a federal court, but you know what I mean, that they have the freedom to be able to author an opinion and to make decisions mm-hmm. without fear of being replaced or fired or harassed. You know, this is the one position that's off limits from having someone in office that might be putting pressure on a position. And so that gives you the freedom to be able to decide opinions the way you feel they should be decided. And yes, you have to choose people in those positions who are able to look at it objectively and able to say, well, internally, probably not externally, it doesn't matter what my personal opinion is, this is what the law requires, or this is how it should go. But when you're actually deciding on issues of public policy, your opinion absolutely comes into play. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, the precedent. So, okay, I'm going to take a moment of silence because this really is significant for us here in the U.S. and probably for people around the world who are watching the U.S. for ideas and guidance. So it's a lot. It's a lot to take in.
Yeah, may she rest in peace.
Thank you. Okay, moving on. So moving on, what is up next?
Well, what is up next is if we stay in the U.S., on the 23rd of September, there was a hearing in Congress on possible federal privacy legislation. Once again, there have been many, but I think this is the first time that I saw a lineup with four former FTC commissioners and the California AG. So around the table were Julie Brill, Maureen Olhausen, John Leibovich, and William Kovacic, as well as Xavier Becerra, the California Attorney General as well. And it's pretty clear that they all of them argued that there should be federal privacy legislation in the U.S. And there were some senators who were interrogating these former FTC commissioners about their views. And I was impressed by Julie Brill's answer, because she argued that not only will a company want to have the option to trade with Europe at some point and thus have that sort of equal level of privacy and data protection, but also that a stronger and clearer data privacy law across the US would be beneficial for the US itself and for US companies, because it enables companies to engage more respectfully and increase trust in themselves, thus increasing competitiveness.
I actually have, I'm not sure it's a very popular your opinion on it, but there are companies who are using privacy and consumer trust as a competitive differentiator. I do not believe that they entered the privacy realm, data protection realm, in the effort to be competitive. Companies that come to mind that are really touting this strongly are Microsoft, Apple, big mega companies that have been able to implement very, very strong privacy programs and then bake it into their products. And so they are making it a competitive differentiator. And some of them are even using it literally in their commercials of advertising their products. So it's really huge. Do I believe that they implemented privacy in order to be a competitive differentiator? No, I don't. I believe it's something that they needed to do because either the law required it or industry standards required it or some sort of government oversight required it, or they got complaints from consumers, whatever it was. There was a driver for them to do it other than them going, oh, we should absolutely protect people's privacy. So, but there are companies who are actually in the privacy field, our company being one of them. And so is privacy a competitive differentiator for us? Absolutely. Aside from those two examples, do I believe that having a U.S. federal privacy law is going to spark competitiveness and innovation between companies? I think I'm pretty skeptical on that. I think companies will do it if the laws require them to, and maybe I shouldn't be so skeptical or cynical, but I still really don't see in the overwhelming amount of businesses in the U.S. that respect and drive that we're going to do this because this is what's right for the people.
There is a second quote that I want to hear your views on, and that is the other main topic that is always discussed when you hear about federal privacy law, and that is preemption. Everybody agreed during the hearing, apparently, that those needs to be avoided. But at the same time, AG Becerra said, give us a playbook, but don't preempt smart, nimble privacy protections that let state meet the varying challenges coming at us. At the same time, here in Europe, what we have actually done is preempt GDPR, because we have said all over Europe, you need to have the same bare minimum of rules, and you can go above and beyond in certain situations, but the basic rules need to be the same.
That's what we do here in the US, is typically the standard is that the federal law will preempt, but that the states can have additional protections on top of those, as long as it is, but they can't actually contradict the federal laws or implement something that would be less than the federal laws. That's the traditional way of doing things.
And that's also how you expect the federal privacy law, if it is coming, what it will look like?
When it comes to preemption in this case, a lot of the debate is because of California. And I don't know this personally. I have not talked to the people that run major California companies to get their opinion, but it is my understanding from popular rumor and seeing evidence of the companies that lobby, a lot of the companies in California are not a big fan of being subject to the CCPA, because there are a lot of requirements in there for privacy programs that are not so commercially friendly. So they would love to have a U.S. federal privacy law that would preempt California's law and would put in provisions that the CCPA might actually contradict, therefore they would be preempted. So that is a big consideration they have to take in place for a federal privacy law. But I also intuit that a federal privacy law, if passed, when passed, will have less requirements than we see in the CCPA. Although it's interesting because we have very strong requirements in HIPAA, and we have very strong requirements in the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, the GLBA, for financial institutions. So with those, why wouldn't we have a very strong privacy law in general passed? If we don't, it's going to be because of the lobbying efforts of the corporations that don't want to be subject to it.
Yeah, so this will be continued undoubtedly after the election as well, but maybe the next term of Congress might finally be the term where we will actually see some real movement on federal privacy legislation.
Yeah, I would expect, and I'll try to get out my crystal ball here, that maybe one of the first things we might see might be a federal breach notification law.
Well, that would be a good start.
Yeah, because we have a lot of similarities across the states and the territories, but we don't have, you know, true consistency. You still have to go look up and see what it is in one state versus another, especially now that a lot of them are adding elements like biometrics to their breach notification laws. So that might be something. So we'll see. But I will tell you that if you ask what is top of my mind coming up in privacy, it might be divorced from a lot of the topics that we actually have very popular right now across the world: the SHRMs, the Shield, Australia law, South Africa law, Brazilian law. There's all of these here. I actually have one that has come across my desk that I'm about to do a webinar on the Office of National Coordinators on behalf of the Health and Human Services information blocking rule, which is part of the 21st Century CARES Act.
Okay, you need to explain that, because those were a lot of words and I have no idea what you're talking about. I understand all of the individual words, that's not the problem, but all of them together, what is this about?
Okay, so the 21st Century CARES Act was passed in December of 2016, and it basically is intended to put a lot of innovation into healthcare here in the United States. There's a lot of different provisions of that law on a lot of different elements, a lot of them based on patient first. There's a lot of funding for research. It does some things for the FDA. It does a lot for the National Institutes of Health, different things like this to spear advancement and innovation and maybe competitiveness. But part of that are some very specific provisions that are intended to put the patient in charge of their information, which is, you know, a precedent we like. But this Information Blocking Act is coming out at pretty much, or blocking rule is coming out at pretty much the same time that the Health and Human Services is putting out their interoperability rule. And so there's a lot of different things in here, but information blocking, essentially boiling it down to its very basic provisions, is that it is intended that no provider and no tech provider, so no healthcare provider, hospitals, doctors, and no electronic health record providers can put in provisions that would block patients from getting their information or from transferring their information from one provider to another. And you might say, well, of course patients have access to their information, or they can, you know, transition information from one provider to another. It's not as simple as it sounds. A lot of this is directed towards health IT. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that, you know, one provider of EHRs, electronic health records, might not be interoperable with another provider of electronic health records. Therefore, patients' information that might be in five different hospitals can't easily be shared with another hospital or with their healthcare provider electronically and embedded into the electronic health record. So therefore, they're calling all the technical capabilities out there right now are essentially information blocking, because they're blocking information being shared among them. Now, there are eight exceptions, and this is what the Office of the National Coordinator, ONC, came out with. There are actually eight exceptions to information blocking. Five of them involve not fulfilling requests for access, exchange, or anything. Three of them involve procedures. So you can decline to fulfill a request for access, and this can be access from the patient or a request to transfer data to another. From if it prevents harm, so if it's something that maybe is in the record that might upset the patient or might cause them to act out in a way that might cause harm either to themselves or someone else, there is preventing harm, privacy, security, infeasibility, or health IT performance exception. So in other words, if you are doing an update to your technology, so your services aren't available, you know, one day a month or something like that, that's not considered information blocking. Mm-hmm. That you can't do it on that one day. The other exceptions on the processes for fulfilling come with licensing, cost, and content and manner. So they're not stopping health IT from being able to charge license fees or to protect their IP. So those are the exceptions for procedures. So they are required, or they are allowed to charge license fees to the providers in order to, you know, exchange the information. They're not going to stop technology from making a profit. I mean, certainly you're not required to give it away for free. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because from the European perspective, you're probably sitting here going, why would you even need a law like that? Mm-hmm. Can't information just be shared openly? Not really.
No, especially not if it's health data. We've had very long debates here in the Netherlands about electronic health records. And so far, all the bills that were in Parliament have been voted down for insufficient privacy protections. Same. So especially when it comes to central sharing and automatic sharing. So far, all the systems are disconnected. And there could be some regional systems, but still you need the individual's consent to be able to be part of the system. And as long as all these systems have not been brought together in a proper manner and with a proper legal basis, I've decided to also withhold my consent to be part of any electronic patient record.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, here it is. The fact that, and it's funny because HIPAA is a very strong privacy law. And I like the fact that there is a provision in there that information can be shared among providers in order to take care of the patient. You don't need the patient's consent to give their information to another provider that is involved in the treatment of that patient. Because, I mean, clearly, that would slow down the provision of care. But it's funny because when you go to a doctor's office, and you might not be familiar with this, but a lot of people here in the US will be, when you go to a doctor's office and you're seeing a specialist, so you got referred from your primary care provider, or you want to, you know, go see another doctor and you have to sign this form for the doctor's office to send it to the other doctor's office to say, please send me the records. Mm-hmm. And the patient has to sign it and it follows all the, you know, very specific requirements of a request under HIPAA. But what's interesting is it's not required.
Oh, wow.
You're not required to get that form signed by a patient in order to get the information from another doctor's office. And if Dr. A receives a request for information from Dr. B on the patient, they're not required to say, oh, well, I need a consent form from the patient. You don't need consent.
Do you need to tell the patient?
Well, in many cases, you don't. I mean, here's the thing. The example I gave, yes, the patient should be aware that they're going to a new doctor. It's all about record keeping. It's all about the doctor being able to say, oh, wait, I didn't just ask for a patient out of the blue. This patient actually is seeing me for treatment and they requested me to get the records. Hmm. So it's all about legal defensibility, which is why they require that form. But the form's not required under the law. Back to whether or not you have to get, the patient has to know. In many cases, they don't. If you go to a hospital emergency room and for whatever reason, and you're going to get x-rays, probably get vitals in that scenario, that the patient has no clue. So maybe the hospital owns the x-ray machine that takes the x-rays, but it's being read by a radiologist, which is not part of the hospital. They're just, you know, contracted to the hospital. So your information is at the places. Even if the hospital has a pharmacy, they may not own the pharmacy. So they may actually, it may be going to a third party provider to fulfill the medications that you're getting upon discharge. It's very interesting how a lot of patients probably have no clue that their information is being shared with so many different providers. And you don't necessarily have to have a business associate agreement with those providers because they may not be doing something on behalf of the hospital. They're actually actively involved in the patient care. And so you can't even say, oh, well, that relationship is, you know, governed under a vendor relationship or something. It's not. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting how you would say, well, doesn't a patient need to know that their data is going to another provider? No, a lot of them probably have no clue. And does it result in a lot of confusion? Yes, it does. Patients that have no idea how this works may get a bill from the hospital. They may get a bill from the radiologist. They may be getting a bill from a third-party x-ray provider if it's a different system. They may be getting a bill from a different pharmacy. Who knows? And all of these bills may come separately. Now, we've tried to clean up that process here in the United States and have one unified billing so that patients not getting bills from six or seven different providers. But it's really interesting how it works here in the US. But this ONC information blocking is mainly related among the fact that a lot of information is kept electronically now and the systems don't talk to each other. And because they're not required to talk to each other, they're saying that it's inhibiting innovation. Mm-hmm. And this is the same reason one of the things in GDPR was put in place, the right to portability, was to increase competitiveness and innovation in the True. Field, because systems should be interoperable to be able to absorb information from a competitor.
Very interesting.
So it's a lot like the same line. And so, yes, I know for our listeners, that was a very, very deep dive into a very nuanced provision. But what's interesting is that this ONC rule came out, I believe, in March. I'd have to look and see exactly when the final rule came out. But it slipped through without a lot of people knowing. But this rule slipped through. And I don't even think I was paying attention to it until a couple of months ago, when I'm like, wait, what do you mean an information blocking rule came out? That's huge in the HIPAA world. Absolutely huge. And the other thing is, and I was just talking to a provider group that is looking at implementing this, and they were asking questions about what are other people doing that I'm talking to. I don't have very many people that are doing anything about it, because it slipped through in the midst of COVID and all the rules and requirements coming out and the going remote and everything like that. A lot of people just have no clue that this information blocking rule came out, except perhaps the electronic health record providers.
Well, at least for all our listeners in the US, they now have it top of mind, so they can start to take a look at it and see what they might need to do about it as well.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. One of the things that came up is that you have to give patient access to their data. And yet there are provisions in HIPAA under the privacy rule that if a patient requests access, just like under GDPR, there are exceptions to requesting access. So the ONC information blocking rule actually incorporates and says, of course, you would follow HIPAA. Mm-hmm. If there is a reason under HIPAA to deny it, you would do it. That part seems to be getting missed in the conversation, in the translation. People aren't realizing this doesn't override HIPAA. It should work alongside HIPAA. And as you know, I'm talking with my hands and weaving my fingers together and making all kinds of really cool air motions here. One of my husbands, that's a whole nother conversation, actually made a comment one time many, many years ago that if you held my hands down, I would stutter.
I think that might be true. Yes.
I think I'm part of Italian. Aren't Italians known for talking with their hands?
All Mediterraneans. See, there we go. All Mediterraneans.
And given that I yell, I definitely think there's some unidentified Italian in my bloodline.
Absolutely.
Or maybe I should be Italian.
Now that we're coming back to Europe, Kay, I wanted to come back to one of the issues that we discussed. I think it was 2 weeks ago when the Wall Street Journal article came out about the enforcement of the Schrems II decision. And during that podcast recording, I commented on the separate procedure that the Irish DPC had initiated to start enforcing the law and present a preliminary compliance order to Facebook to suspend all data transfers under the standard contractual clauses.
Right. And Irish Data Protection Commissioner is being very active in some of their inquiries and investigations. I'm loving what they're doing.
Absolutely. But I've been given this some further thought. And let's first listen back to what I said 2 weeks ago. This is not the enforcement following the Schrems II decision. The Irish DPC has launched a separate investigation into these data transfers that has resulted in the preliminary compliance order that the Wall Street Journal cited on. But that is a bit strange, I believe, because the Schrems II case, or the Schrems cases, have been running for so long, and also the Irish High Court in the past already said this should end sooner rather than later. And to suddenly have a separate case where the enforcement would take place and where the result would be similar to what Mr. Schrems is trying to achieve, it is still strange in my view that it would be in a separate case instead of a decision in something that has been going on so long. You know, what I said here is that it was strange that the Irish DPC is bringing forward a separate case. And a reflection, and also talking to some more people about it, it is not that strange at all, because if they would have just continued with the Schrems case and just dealt with the complaint of Mr. Schrems and given Facebook a preliminary compliance order in that case, it would only have effect to Mr. Schrems. Whereas In this case, it would be erga omnes. So it would apply to everybody in all of Europe whose data is being processed by Facebook and transferred to the US under these standard contractual clauses. So actually, upon further reflection, it actually does make a lot of sense that they have chosen this path. So I just wanted to get back to that.
I'm glad you did, because, you know, there's a lot of things that happen in European privacy law that perhaps on their face look like one thing, but if you actually look into it deeper or just consider the public interest, the further implications, the impact that this might have across a broader Europe, it actually makes more sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this was all hot off the press when we recorded, so there was not a lot of time to do some further reflection. But yeah, I think in the end, it does make sense. We know by now also that Facebook has requested a judicial review of the preliminary order and has also received the leave from the Irish High Court to do so. And that will undoubtedly take time. So we may be having Christmas after all this year, because I think by now it is becoming highly unlikely that the DPC will be able to put forward a final decision on this compliance order to the European Data Protection Board anytime soon, let alone that it will be finalized in time before the end of the year with the High Court procedure taking place. And to be honest, None of Your Business and the Schrems Group might have cut their own fingers here a little bit by disclosing the confidential letters between the DPC and Mr. Schrems that give the enforcement timeline, because that enforcement timeline was then used by Facebook in the High Court proceedings to get the leave to get that judicial review. So all in all, whether it was wise to publish those letters, I don't know. We know that Facebook and the Irish DPC will have another day in court.
Beautiful.
If you like the podcast, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustart.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as EuroPolB. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy, and until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.